Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:48 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is March 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There were a number of significant pullbacks this week, and perhaps the most important of those are going to be on the S&P and the A shares in China. It is, even though the decline was trimmed a little in here today, we're working on a downside weekly key reversal on the S&P 500. That's one of the things that is key to the key is, or the key to the key is size. And this pullback has not been as large, for example, as the big outside week that we had, for example, in December. And it's just about the same size as the pullback that we had at the beginning of February. So, obviously, there are going to be a lot of people looking at the potential for follow-through next week. So far, the index is still above the trend mean, and that's a significant issue. It's a significant factor. This is the first down week after 10 consecutive weeks on the upside. So, it has been inevitable that we're going to get some form of consolidation, and now that consolidation has started. The very big question that remains as yet unanswered is, how deep is this consolidation going to be? One of the things that has certainly been at the back of my mind over the course of the last few weeks has been that we've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. If I just pull back a little onto this 10-year chart. This significant pullback we had from October through December was a very significant event. It was the largest pullback we've seen in the context of a 10-year advance. We'd had a loss of momentum prior to that. The index had certainly lost momentum at the penultimate high. That's something that we see reasonably often. And particularly in a lengthy medium-term trend, we have had a storming rebound over the course of the last 10 weeks. Now the question is whether this is going to be a period of right-hand extension following a type 2 top, or is it going to be just part of a lengthier consolidation within an ongoing bull market? And that is the question we're going to have answered over the course of the next few months, because it's looking increasingly likely that we are now at the end of this 10-week advance, and the short covering rally has run its course. People are now starting to weigh up their options, whether that is that we've had a significant reset in terms of valuations, whether the economy is in fact slowing. There was some speculation along those lines in here today with a new jobs print that was only 20,000 relative to an expected number in the region of about 200,000. But unemployment is still low. Wages are definitely rising. There is no bones about it that's clearly inflationary. So there are obviously a number of different strands to the argument. But perhaps the most important of those is that when you get a significant pullback like we had between October and December, it's deleterious to sentiment. And when people have sat through that kind of profit erosion, and then subsequently you get the rebound, well, it's very hard to muster the emotional capital to jump straight back in to the market again. There's a lot of people are still sitting in cash. The 2-year interest rate is around 2.5%. But when, for example, we look at 3-month bills, well, LIBOR, for example, is at 2.6%. So that's a significant return for 3-month money. And if you're in cash, then you don't have that same urgency to get back into the stock market as you would have had when interest rates were zero. So Then, of course, you have the question when we look at some of the shares that had moved on to new all-time highs and are now sitting on downside weekly key reversals. Well, we have to then at least begin to consider that we are potentially in a, and I should I think highlight that Salesforce is not a downside key because it did not move to a new intra-week high in here this week, but it's certainly a big downward dynamic and is looking increasingly likely that it is a failed upside break. Well, what this is also representative of when we look at some of the companies in the cloud computing sector that had been at the center of very significant advances and that had really been immune to the kind of pullbacks that we saw in October through December, that they are now starting to encounter some resistance and that the pace of their advances are starting to moderate. Well, even here, where we had the best performing sector, we're starting to see some reticence about paying new all-time highs. Because if we think about it simply logically, when you get to a new all-time high, you have to be pretty bullish about the medium to longer term prognosis for the market, because you're in virgin territory. You're in areas where you don't have any historical precedent for the price having traded previously. So that is something that obviously people are starting to think about as we get up towards the highs, and people are asking, well, am I willing to sit through volatility again? So we're definitely, I think, or at least to the extent that anything is definite in markets, I think there is certainly the scope here for additional consolidation. The best case scenario for the NASDAQ or for the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones is that they consolidate above the trend mean. That would be really, really would be the best of all possible worlds. If we were to see something like that, then there's a, I think, a strong likelihood that the these indices are going to be at new all-time highs by the end of this year. I think the more likely scenario, though, is that we are going to get a somewhat deeper pullback. Generally, when you get a rebound like this, it's quite normal that you can see 50% of the advance unwound. So that could take the NASDAQ, for example, back down to 6,500 points. There is, of course, then the additional potential that we could go right back down and test the low, or at least approximate the low and potentially put in a higher reaction low, and that's also a potential outcome. And I would then obviously we have to think about the potential that the market could move to a new low, and then we'd really be talking about a completed top formation. So this is a very interesting area where we can see that there are a number of potential outcomes. But so far, we have not yet had downside follow-through, and there are there is still a an absence of profit erosion, considering that we've had such a very impressive rebound. So that's certainly, I think, when we think about the medium-term outlook, that's obviously a big question. And the extent to which the US economy is going to slow down is probably going to have a significant effect on perceptions and then sentiment towards the market. When we think about the outlook for stocks generally, then there was research released in here today about the impact of buybacks, which is potentially significant because companies have plowed $4.5 trillion back into buybacks over the course of the last decade. And when I've created this, I created this chart of the outstanding, all the outstanding shares on the NYSE back in 2013 when I was writing Crowd Money. And we can see that the number of shares outstanding today is higher than it was at any point before 2014. That's despite the fact that we've had trillions of dollars of shares bought up by the companies themselves. So we have to at least ask the question, where did all those shares go? If the number of shares is still very high, well, a lot of them have gone to compensate the, or to, I think, counterbalance would probably be the better term, the number of shares that have been awarded to executives and awarded to employees as part of their remuneration packages. That's an awful lot of money that's been doled out to senior employees at some corporations. I think it's, therefore, it is, I think it's important to look at the number of shares outstanding in a number of these companies. So, for example, when we look at the number of shares that are outstanding on Facebook, for example, it really hasn't changed very much since 2015. But when we look at, for example, Amazon, well, they have been continuing to issue shares on a progressively on a progressive basis since their IPO, really, back in the late 1990s. But when, for example, we look at Apple, well, Apple have been buying back shares for the last 5 or 6 years, and that has contributed to their number of outstanding shares contracting. Then one of the companies that has been most aggressive in buying back its shares, IBM, has seen its share count contract from about 23, or I should say it's I don't actually know whether that index on the outside is in millions or billions, but let's just call it the 2300 level to just under 900. So they have certainly contracted the number of shares outstanding. Microsoft has been less aggressive in buying up its own shares, but it certainly has been, the number of shares outstanding has been contracting over the course of the last few years. Obviously, then, when we look at some of the Dividend Aristocrat companies, they have also been buying back their shares, but that hasn't been as much of a factor over the course of the last couple of years as it has been overall. Dividend growth for these companies has generally been a higher priority. So I think these are, when we look at the buybacks, there is an ongoing argument about what kind of value that represents for the market. So on the one hand, it definitely reduces the number of shares outstanding for at least some companies. And how effective that is going to be really influenced by how generous the board is for the senior executives in particular. There is obviously another argument that they really should be trying to find more productive ways to spend their profits in order to boost the fundamental value of the their businesses. Of course, that is an uncertain prospect. It's and it's more risky from a management or a board's perspective to go off and bet on new business lines than it is to just give the buy back their own shares. So obviously people calling for greater investment is obviously something that companies are doing. R&D is still, in nominal terms at least, is continuing to grow, but it is not growing as quickly as profits have been. But the other point about buybacks is that they have been the primary conduit through which monetary largesse has been entering the market, because a lot of the debt that has been taken on over the course of the last decade has been deployed into the stock market through share buybacks. So that is a significant issue. If the buybacks have contributed to leverage ratios in the corporate sector rising, well, then that is obviously a very clear argument for why they shouldn't be following that kind of strategy. So I think we can say with confidence that there are a number of different strands to this argument, and there is not a one-size-fits-all solution, that share buybacks are part of a suite of policies that a company can engage in, but that it doesn't make a lot of sense to make sweeping statements about whether they are good or bad. But what we certainly know is that there would appear to be cross-party support to act against them, because one of the primary characteristics of share buybacks and one of the attributes that has been touted by investors is that they are more tax efficient than dividends. And the one thing we're all aware of is that governments are broke, so they have an incentive to try and tax share buybacks, whether that is to inhibit companies from doing it or whether to tax the share buybacks in a manner similar to capital gains. Those are two measures that have gained cross-party support. We're about 18 months away from the US presidential election, so that also is something that is quite likely to become part of the discussion or the electoral platform that that parties start to adopt. Now, when we look at what's going on in the bond markets, then I think this is a rather interesting... Oops, I'm in the wrong box typing. When we look at the 10-year Treasury yield, we are at, I think, a very important juncture here, because the yield has contracted significantly this week, and it was in negative territory again today. It's now right at the lower side of its range. So we have just very faint evidence of support starting to come back in. 2.5% is a big psychological level. And we already know that the yield curve is very flat. So when we look at, for example, the 2-year, then we can see that there's only about 20 basis points between the two measures. The big question is whether the Federal Reserve is done with raising interest rates. Now, the bond market, as long as that yield is trading below the trend mean, is concluding that the Federal Reserve is done with raising interest rates. But wage growth is picking up, and therefore we have a clear argument that is likely to manifest itself, because the stock market and the bond markets have concluded that the Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates again in this cycle. The one big question that we had last year was, does the market have a Powell put? The market generally tends to manufacture crises in order to test the resolve of central bankers. They did it with Paul Volcker. They did it with, certainly it was the case with Greenspan during 1987. Then we obviously had Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen. So they've had to deal with crises on their own. And now Jay Powell. The Federal Reserve did nothing in the face of a 10% pullback last January. They continued to raise interest rates. They continued to reduce the size of the balance sheet. And they were rewarded with a 20% pullback. And that was enough to create enough of stress within the central bank that they came out and said that they are ready to deploy all the tools that are available to them, that they could potentially pause or reassess the pace with which they're raising interest rates, and that they are now on the cusp of announcing when they are going to end their reduction in the size of the balance sheet. So we have now got confirmation that there is a Powell put, that they are going to do whatever it takes, that it is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that there will be additional extraordinary monetary policy measures implemented in the event that we do have another problem. But they're going to be rather shy about raising interest rates. But wage growth broke out this week, and it has moved from a pace of 2.5% at the beginning of 2018 to 3.4% in the space of a year. So wage growth is not just picking up, but it is starting to accelerate higher. And we know what happened last time when it got up to 3.5%, and against a background of full employment, well, that risks overheating in the market. That is when the central bank is forced to start to act. But what it also represents is inflationary pressures. And that really does highlight the potential for stagflation, where you get the central bank that does not want to raise interest rates, but you also have inflationary pressures rising. Well, gold tends to do well in that kind of environment because it holds out the prospect of negative real interest rates. And gold tends to do best in exactly that environment when you have negative real interest rates. Some people think that gold is a great hedge against inflation, but that's only partially true. It's really only a good hedge against inflation when inflationary measures are rising faster than the central bank is willing to raise interest rates. Again, that's the definition of negative real interest rate environment. And of course, in a deflationary environment, interest rates are zero, and therefore gold has no competition. So then you also have a negative real interest rate environment. Gold bounced today from the region of the trend mean, and this was a reasonably dynamic move. It was certainly the biggest up move we've had since the day before the short-term peak back in February. I think it is important to pay particular attention to the fact that gold has been ranging below $1,350 for 6 years. And when we look at the broad pattern, well, we're presented with a base formation, and this base formation has had higher reaction lows since the beginning of 2016. I mean, we are still talking about gold, so it does tend to be volatile, and it does tend to pull back in a violent manner. And the one thing we know that from trading precious metals is that you don't pay up for commodities. But if we are in an environment where the US economy is on the cusp of inflation, where there is the realistic possibility that there could be indigestion from the bond markets, the one thing we know for certain is that there is a very large quantity of debt that needs to be refinanced this year. Then there is the additional call on the bond markets because of the deficits that need to be funded, and the deficit is likely to be higher again next year. The one cross-party bill that could potentially get through Congress, despite the polarization between the parties, is an infrastructure bill, and that would expand the deficit even further. But then you also have the potential that we could have an agreement between China and the USA, which would require China to buy more goods. Well, one of the natural effects of the Chinese buying more goods and closing the trade imbalance would be less of a need for holding treasuries. And if they're holding fewer treasuries, then that would also put upward pressure on yields. So, despite the fact that the bond market today is not particularly worried about raising interest rates, they're really much more concerned with pricing in the potential for an economic slowdown. There are other factors that are particularly relevant to the bond markets that suggest that we could potentially see some quite a lot of volatility in the bond markets over the next while. What's also, I think, rather important here is that when we look at the high yield spreads, then they're around the 400 basis point level. Last week they were 385, so we've had an 18 basis point pop on the upside this week. This represents the region of the trend mean. The kind of move we've had over the course of the last 6 to 8 months is eerily similar to what we saw in 2014. And if we go all the way back and look at the events that we had back in 2007, well, we had the initial pop on the upside out of a really well-defined range, and then it pulled back to the region of the trend mean. Well, that's exactly what the high yield spread has done just now. This is going to be particularly important to monitor if the yield sustains a move above 5%. Because it's above 5% that we get the significant wobbles in the market. So that's, I think, something that is particularly important. Well, it also suggests that when we look at the rally that we've had in high yield debt, well, it's looking rather rich. And there have been a succession of lower rally highs, and on each occasion that it has been able to push above the trend mean since the middle of 2017, it has failed. So if the stock market does pull back next week, then we can anticipate that the high yield spread is going to expand, and that the HYG or the junk ETFs are probably going to break downwards. Excuse me. So I think that's certainly a potential outcome. Now, when we look at Amazon, I think this is one of the most important charts at the moment, because it is right in the region of the lower side of its range. It was trading below $1,600 for a time in here today, but it was able to recoup much of the loss. This tight range between $1,600 and $1,700 is not going to last indefinitely. And if it breaks on the downside, it's likely to correspond with a rather significant pullback in the wider market. If, on the other hand, it breaks on the upside, well, then that is going to hold out the prospect for additional improvement in terms of the performance of the S&P 500. But then I think we also need to pay some attention to the Russell 2000, because that was a big downward dynamic that we saw this week. And the big question I think a lot of people are asking is whether that 1500 point level is going to hold. It is now right in the region of the trend mean. Then the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is often a lead indicator, and it had rallied incredibly impressively all the way back up to 1400 and then pulled back to the region of the trend mean in here this week. Well, again, this is another index. If it can manage to sustain this move above the trend mean and merely go sideways for the next few weeks, that would be really a very positive outcome indeed to what has been a very big uptick in terms of volatility for the index. But obviously, what happens in terms of China is going to be a very big influence on what we can anticipate from the semiconductors index. And the A-share index in China today was down 143 points, which was over 3%. And that was a very clear downward dynamic. Well, I'd been saying in just the last couple of audios that we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside until we get a clear downward dynamic, and here it is. So that suggests that we're now going to get a reversion back to the mean. What it also tends to question is the Chinese administration's appetite for bubbly behavior. So they're beginning to start to move to try and contain speculative interest. That doesn't mean that we're going to see the index come all the way back down, but it does suggest that we are in for some consolidation in terms of the performance we've seen so far. I think it's also worth highlighting that the benchmark index for futures traders in China is the CSI 300. It's got a very similar pattern to the A-share index, and it is available to international investors. The other index that I think people do look at is the A50 from FTSE. And sorry, I didn't type that particularly effectively. Well, this has a very different chart pattern. It has tended, it has been underperforming over the course of the last couple of days, not least because it has a significant weighting in insurance companies. Ping An represents 12.3% of the index. And then when we think about the fact that it was PIC Group that pulled back in here today because it got a sell rating from one of the brokerages, well, then that did, I think, wrap the A50 index on the knuckles. It's a rather significant downside key reversal that confirms the progression of lower rally highs on PIC Group. That suggests that there's going to be two-way action in terms of the trading environment that we're going to see in China. But I think if we start to think about what it is that China wants and what the outlook is for the economy there, one of the things that Mrs. Tracy has been highlighting, she's over there at the moment in Guangzhou and Shenzhen, buying inventory for her business, and the two of the things that she really drew to, brought to my attention over the last couple of days was that YouTube is working, and that it is available in any of the hotels that she's been frequenting. Well, that's a significant change. It suggests that the government is starting to ease up, but at the same time, when you go to the train station, they are asking to check people's phones. And what they're looking for is the browsing history on people's phones and whether they have VPNs installed. So on the one hand, people in hotels are not being clamped down on because that was a particular inconvenience for foreigners visiting China. But there are still controls underway in terms of trying to monitor the activity of the domestic population. Well, I think that is representative of Xi Jinping's rule, that he is trying to clamp down on any form of protest. And what can be considered to be a protest is anything at all that does not conform to the party line. So what we've seen internationally is that Chinese diplomats have become much more assertive, and that particularly in places like the USA and Canada and Europe, where they are starting to voice their opinions much more vocally. Well, one of the reasons for that is because they need to be coming out as seen as tough and enforcing the Communist Party's way of thinking if they want to hold on to their jobs. China has got clear ambitions to become the global hegemon. And I think that's something that is really worth thinking about, because the USA went into the negotiations with China in order to try and, I think, levelize the playing field, to make a very clear statement that they're not going to tolerate China flexing its muscles on the global stage while also taking advantage of very favorable trade conditions. So that's what the root of the trade war has been. For China, they probably do want to have a deal, for the simple reason that their objectives of becoming the global supreme economy are rooted in forecasts for the region around 2030 to 2040. And if that growth is impeded today, well, then they won't reach those goals. They do tend to think more in terms of decades than months, and that is one of their strengths. So it's certainly in China's interests to deal with the USA right now. if for no other reason than that they're still biding their time. And one of the things that was certainly announced in here this week is that they have boosted their military budget by over 7%. That's against a background where they are also introducing tax cuts. So there is going to be fiscal stimulus, and that is one of the reasons why the stock market has been rallying. Obviously, there is a governance deficit in China that is not going to be corrected imminently, but bull markets in the region or in the country tend to be state-sponsored. We saw the first evidence just here today that some of the state sponsorship is waning, considering the speed with which the market has gone up. But the last thing they want is for the stock market to pull back in a meaningful way. So it's likely that simply the pace of the advance is going to moderate. If this trade war is we get an agreement to it sometime this month, then that is likely to be positive for stock markets in the short to medium term. But we can't lose sight of the fact that the only reason that China would agree to a trade agreement that for which they're probably going to end up paying, well, the only reason they would accept that is as simply a stopgap measure before they can achieve more of their political objectives. We kind of know what those are going to be. They're in the process of launching, rather than supporting the International Space Station, they're going to launch a Chinese space station. They are experimenting with putting hypersonic kinetic weapons in the field. What I find particularly interesting is that the media was abuzz over the last couple of weeks with the notion that the U.S. Army is going to put artificial intelligence into tanks. Quite apart from the fact that Russia has already done that, that Russia already has automated tanks in the field that can select targets. So the USA is already behind on that front, and that there is some agonizing going on about exactly what can be done. But that is also a very clear example of the fact that generals are always fighting the last battle. It's quite unlikely that any future conflagration is going to involve tank battles at all. If they have hypersonic kinetic weapons, that is the military equivalent of a targeted meteorite. It's a non-nuclear solution that can evaporate a city in very short order. And both Russia and China are fielding these kinds of weapons today. Well, what that suggests is that China is going to continue building aircraft carriers. They are going to continue to expand into space, because it is in space that we have potentially the next theater for war. Considering that both the cost and the efficiency of launching space vehicles has improved beyond measure over the last decade, well, that really is a clear sign that there is massive potential for innovation on the space horizon, whether that is going to be manufacturing in space, whether that is going to be drug discovery in a zero-gravity environment, whether it is going to be mining asteroids or shooting down satellites. There are massive opportunities and risks, and it is absolutely inevitable that those opportunities and risks are going to be explored over time. That has to be remembered when we think about what is going to be the outcome of these trade negotiations. So I think that's certainly something. I saw an article today that a number of companies like Dell and EMC are instructing their Taiwanese manufacturing or third-party manufacturers to relocate the production of power cords out of China and back to Taiwan, for the simple reason that they can be used as hacking devices. So when we think about the news story that broke last year about the interdiction of the supply chain, I find it amazing that people who've never really had very much experience of visiting factories in China, that they are so confident in doubting the veracity of it. I've been to factories, both large and small, all over China. I've got a high degree of confidence that if the Communist Party wanted to infiltrate the manufacturing of anything that happens in China, then that is something they can do relatively easily. Well, what I think that obviously there are very clear parallels with the evil empire. The simple fact of the matter is that China is a global power. They have their own clear self-interest, and that is not necessarily aligned with ours. And that is going to be a significant factor over the course of the long term. Technological innovation accelerates when you have both the development of the kinds of facilitating technologies that can allow greater communication, greater collaboration, and therefore the uptick in development. But the technological innovation also accelerates during times of war and preparation for war because the impetus, and or I guess it, you get a needs must kind of way of thinking about things. I think that's a good reason that we should be thinking about the technology sector, that it is likely to continue to represent a bullish phenomenon. But the much bigger question today is how close are we to a recession? The yield curve spread is still contracting. Then, when we look at the total assets of balance of the central banks, that has been contracting over the course of the last few weeks, having had a bounce in the first month of this year. It has been contracting. Part of the reason it's been contracting has been the clear outperformance of the dollar. Despite the fact the dollar was a somewhat weaker in here today, it has held a progression of higher reaction lows since the end of January. That has reduced the value of the assets sitting on central banks internationally. That alone is one of the reasons why central bank buying of gold has been improving. When we look at the outlook for the US economy, well, we know that they've been raising interest rates for quite some time. The big question, I think, is in terms of the performance of consumer staples, considering that these are the kinds of things that people buy all the time, and it has lost momentum. So that is representative of a slowdown, not just in the US economy, but the global economy. And when we think about the where we are in terms of the stock market and the broad market cycle, we've been addicted to liquidity. So the outlook for China and their willingness to stimulate their economy, whether that is for their own interests or those of the international economy, that's largely beside the point. If they can stimulate the economy, that will be beneficial for stock markets generally. What we saw in terms of Europe this week was somewhat different. The Euro Stoxx index was in negative territory in here today, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean. Downside follow through here next week, very similar to what we saw with Wall Street, is likely to represent at least a peak of near-term significance, and then the question is how much of this rebound can it possibly hold. But I am very much reminded of the first example from the chart seminar, and that is where past support becomes future resistance. And this level around the 375 area was an area of support all the way through to 2017 and 2018, and now the index is pausing in this area. It's a natural area where people could at least say, well, at least I'm getting out at around the lower side of the range that persisted previously. It's obviously an area where people could begin to start taking profits. So I think when we think about what's going on in terms of monetary policy in Europe, the rather miserly source of additional liquidity that came out of the ECB yesterday has frightened the market. They are making less money available. They are reducing the maturity of the loans, and then they are charging more for it. Well, all of that is something that has contributed to weakness in terms of the euro. The European region has got significant challenges, and the most important of those is the rise of populism. The rise of populism is a direct result of the imposition of austerity. The whole reason they introduced austerity was that there was no willingness among the creditors and debtors to write off loans during the sovereign wealth crisis. The only reason it's called a sovereign wealth crisis in Europe, but a credit crisis in the USA, is because the debt to GDP ratios of a number of the sovereigns were really in very healthy condition before the crisis, and then they were forced to absorb massive quantities of loans from the banks because the creditors in Northern Europe would not take the haircut from malinvestment in Southern Europe. So that has contributed to the austerity program. The whole purpose of the austerity program was not so much to pay back the debts, because that is going to take substantially longer, but rather that it is going to equalize the debt to GDP ratios. And that is part of the broader federalist agenda that has been set within the European Commission. Again, this is bureaucrats thinking on the very long term. They are anticipating that debt to GDP ratios will be equalized by the time we get out to about 2030. It's at that point that they will try and push through a common banking system, the imposition of a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, similar to the USA's FDIC. Well, what that's going to do is quite simply introduce the potential for unity, that we could then move towards a fiscal and political and monetary union. Well, nobody seems to have asked people who live in Europe whether they actually want that, whether they are willing to tolerate another decade of austerity in order to achieve that. That's why we have the rise of populism, and that is why populism is at new all-time highs. The last time we had anything close to this kind of populist eruption was in the 1930s, but it is quite likely that we're going to see populism rise much more in the coming years, because we're now talking about a global phenomenon, whereas previously it had really only been a European phenomenon. One thing that I think is quite interesting about the euro is that it paused at 116, and it paused at 115, and it paused at 114, and it bounced in here today. Well, I think anyone who's trading euros is going to be looking at 113 as the next area to short it. And I think we may see that opportunity at some point over the course of the next 2 weeks. This is still an environment where the price is deteriorating, and there is little prospect of the ECB raising interest rates. The fact that it has only taken 24 hours for the ECB and some of the members of the governing panel to come out and say that they really don't think that the growth forecasts announced yesterday are even remotely accurate. They're considered to be wildly out of whack with the reality on the ground. Well, that is very clearly suggesting that the euro needs to get lower. And when we think about the outlook for the US dollar, there are massive sources of deficits, and it is simply that it is the best looking currency at the moment. But that's only because the US economy is still expanding. As long as the US economy is expanding faster than everywhere else, then that's likely to be positive for the dollar. But it's not something that we can simply take for granted. These are significant issues. These are some of the risks that are out there on the horizon. We know what some of the solutions are going to be. We know that central banks are not going to simply give up on their extraordinary monetary policy, and that we're going to get more fiscal stimulus as well. Part of the reason that gold is starting to do better now is exactly for those reasons. Gold investors are starting to price in the very real potential that the answer to the issues that are outstanding internationally is going to be weaker fiat currencies. And you can't simply print or lend gold into existence. Then we know what the other solutions are going to be, because technological innovation is going to be the it is obviously deflationary, and governments need deflation. On the one hand, they need to try and inflate their debts away, but they need productivity growth. They need the kind of good deflation that delivers. The only way we're going to get that is, I think, through continuing to support technological innovation. The very clear evolution of the healthcare sector. I think the provision of customized medicine is already starting to come through. It's quite expensive to deliver today, but the costs are coming down at an exponential rate as the ease of genetic sequencing, genetic editing, and synthetic biology, where they simply write the DNA as code. Well, those three fields are massively supportive of further innovation and providing solutions to some of the most expensive problems we have in the world today. What I find particularly interesting is that everyone has got a very clear understanding that energy prices are a headwind to global growth. And when energy is trending higher, well, every $10 advance in the oil price represents a shaving of about 0.1 or 0.2% off of GDP growth. What we also know about the energy sector is that it tends to go through very lengthy bear markets where prices range. And we're in one of those right now. Then it could be another 20 years before we get the next really significant bull market. And those bull markets generally tend to last for about a decade. They basically last for as long as it takes for a new, more expensive source of supply to reach the market. In this case, it's been shale oil and gas. If the marginal cost of production was below $40 between 1980 and 2004, well, today we can say that the marginal cost of production is probably somewhere around $40 or somewhat higher than that. That suggests that it's going to be difficult for prices to move below that level, and there is ample supply above $80, which suggests then we're going to be in 100% range from trough to peak, from $40 to about $80 for the foreseeable future. But the world spends trillions of dollars a year on energy, but we spend approximately $1 trillion a year on cancer care alone. Diabetes costs the global economy about $900 billion, and these are very significant figures. if we think about the fact that arthritis affects massive numbers of people and is so far completely incurable, then we can see that there is incredible potential to treat chronic conditions by genetic means. And those are the kinds of evolutions in terms of the market that could produce massive productivity gains. If we think about the number of people that drop out of the workforce because of diabetes, or drop out of the workforce because they start to have arthritic pain and the difficulty of just getting up and going to work becomes progressively more difficult as they age, and then the quantity of money that is expended on cancer care, well, these are all massive sources of inhibiting factors to the productivity of the global economy. And they represent a particular threat to the healthcare sector because if we actually look at the products that the major health providers are making money from, the two big sectors are chronic conditions, because you can make a lot of money by treating symptoms rather than curing diseases, and mental health, because mental health can't be cured either. So people tend to take antidepressants and take anti-schizophrenia drugs or anti-bipolar drugs for their entire lives. Those are the kinds of products that the conventional pharmaceutical sectors have got under, or that they are not particularly investing in cures for. Eventually, we are going to get cures for some of the most chronic conditions like diabetes and arthritis, and that will represent a significant challenge to the pharmaceutical sectors that depend on those chronic conditions for their all of their revenue. Now, then we have the evolution of 5G. Now, we're hearing a lot more about that in the news right now, for the simple reason that Huawei is trying to be, or governments are trying to excise Huawei from the bidding process to build out these networks. But 5G is essential for the evolution of the Internet of Things. And the number of IP addresses is going to expand massively over the course of the next decade, so that we're going to have much more connectivity in terms of our lives, our homes, and our workplaces. And that represents the potential for growth in terms of both personal productivity and the introduction of artificial intelligence into more mundane tasks. So that is also a source of really quite significant productivity growth. Then we have the evolution of autonomous vehicles. And we're right at the beginning of that today. And Google is, I think, arguably the leader in terms of providing that kind of service. What I found particularly interesting when visiting Phoenix in January was when I asked around about the Waymo cars that I was anticipating seeing around Chandler. I didn't see any to start off with, and most people were completely oblivious. Well, what that really suggests is that we're really at the early stages of autonomous vehicles. It's probably going to take a while before we get up to a position where there are no drivers at the wheel. But once we hit that catalytic event, then the number of autonomous vehicles is likely to explode, and that will change the global economy beyond recognition. It will greatly enhance productivity. So these are very significant factors. We know where the potential for productivity growth is coming from. And when we look at the long-term, log charts for the major indices. Well, we know that they do tend to have these very lengthy ranges, and the ranges can last anything up to 20 years. And we have lots of evidence of that. If we go all the way back to 1900, we can see that we get very significant bull markets and then very lengthy ranges, and that the bull markets have tended to last upwards of 20 years, and the ranges can last anything from 13 to 20 years. Well, we've completed one of the most recent ranges back in 2013. And this advance is still ongoing. The one thing that has not happened in terms of 100 years of history is, despite the fact that markets go through recessions and we've had occasional crashes along the way, markets do not come all the way back down to the base formation. So when we think about where the potential is and this loss of consistency that we've had, it's quite unlikely that the market is going to have from the peak that we had up in the region of about 2900. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to have a much more volatile environment somewhere in that box between 2 and 3,000, but it's unlikely we're going to see the breakout fail. We know that basically every secular bull market we've had has been fueled by technological innovation. That's likely to continue to be the case. The fact that energy prices are more likely to range than trend for the foreseeable future is also supportive of the bull market hypothesis. We're going to have to get over the debt issues. There is probably going to have to be some form of reordering in terms of the social dynamic in a number of countries to tackle the rise of populism. And that could contribute to a very significant period of underperformance in markets for a couple of years if it's associated with a recession. So that is the risk that is out there. And against that background, the fact that gold prices are coming back up towards the upper side of a six-year range, that suggests that people are buying insurance. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.